So we're going to finish up what we were talking about last week. Very, very briefly, going to talk about the seven crusades that followed the first crusade and just kind of how those ended up, what the purpose for them was, and just give you a very, very brief overview. But then we're going to dive into a topic that I referenced maybe 2 or 3 weeks into this this series about the Israelites going into Canaan and waging what seems to be a holy war to exterminate the people of Canaan. And then you have the concept of jihad in Islam and their empire building, where they would go into areas and sometimes carry out these types of exterminations, but typically it would not be to the point where they would just completely annihilate groups of people. It seemed as though that those types of actions were kind of reserved for specific situations in the Muslim Empire. But certainly lots of death, lots of destruction, and they claimed way more territory than the children of Israel ever claimed in Canaan. So the Muslim Empire included North Africa, portions of Eastern Africa, Spain, Asia Minor, even Canaan itself, which the Israelites invaded after their running from Pharaoh. So there's some kind of like what we talked about with the Crusades. Usually with the conflicts of Christianity and Islam, there's always a comparison that's drawn. And so how can Christians on one side accuse Muslims of terrorism and violence when the history of Christianity has been filled with terrorism and violence as well? What makes your terrorism and violence better than anyone else's, right? And that's kind of the theme that a lot of modern historians use when talking about the American Revolution, talking about the World Wars. So just because the United States is involved in a war, that one's okay. But if another country does something that they feel is similar, whether they're fighting a revolution or fighting a war that they say is in self-defense, then you know, we kind of cast them as the enemy. Perfect example of that is what happened over the weekend with Iran attacking Israel, because a bunch of people in the United States that are anti-Israel and really anti-America as well are saying, well, Israel attacked the embassy that Iran had in Syria, and so this is a response that Iran had, and the U.S. would do the exact same thing. So we can't stand in judgment of Iran. Okay, so it's this age-old us against them, what really is the difference? And we have really this atheist view of history to thank for that type of mentality, as we're always trying to be as objective as possible. And any type of religion is just automatically subjective and can just, you throw everything out as soon as you talk about religion. So I'm going to kind of take it a little bit different route, as opposed to just giving like a history of the Israelites going into Canaan and the Muslims expanding their empire, but we'll expand on that once I get to those that part here in a little bit. So the Crusades are going to continue. You can see the dates there, 1095 to 1291. Several generations of Europeans go on these Crusades. It seems almost as you look at it, if you, depending on how you measure generations, which there's a bunch of different ways to do that, but it really is almost like one crusade per generation. It's spanning over 200 years. You divide that by 8, and yeah, right around that mark. And sometimes when the Christians would go to the Holy Land, they would claim victory, military victory, but it really just depends on, again, which side you are, which story you want to tell, and also what the goal of the crusade was, because it becomes less and less clear why the Europeans exactly are going to Israel the farther you get into crusade history. So the closer you get to 1291, the more you're like, okay, so why are you doing this again? Because you're kind of banging your head against the proverbial wall. There's not really a whole lot to accomplish at this point, and the Muslim victories seem to be stacking up. The first crusade, like we talked about, was a success, and Jerusalem was retaken. But by the third crusade, it's the fourth crusade, Jerusalem falls into the hands of Saladin, and it stays that way. The Jerusalem's never not going to be reclaimed by Christians from that point on. Yet we have four other crusades. It becomes political in nature, and really saying that it becomes political is inaccurate, because whenever you're dealing with the Roman Catholic Church, it kind of just automatically is political, especially during this time, because the popes are trying to expand political power, political influence. They're not so much interested in keeping the faith at all. They just know that with their religious guilt trip, if you will, that they can put kings on, that they can control the actions that they make. So if you tie somebody's spirituality to political decisions, the popes will learn very early on that the kings of Europe just become their puppets and they can just kind of do whatever they want to them, because after all, God wills it, right? No, but the Pope does. So it's very self-serving, and the Crusades become this adopted mentality of kings in Europe. So it's not just the Pope that's calling for them. Sometimes just kings of Europe will call for Crusades. But, you know, similar themes. They're going to reclaim the Holy Land. There's these religious overtones and are not very successful. There's a lot of distractions on the way to the Crusades, and that's why I say, like, the later ones, especially after the Fourth Crusade, you just kind of wonder what it is that they're trying to accomplish, because a lot of the Crusades don't even make it to Israel. They don't even make it to that area. So there's plenty of Crusades that are sent that aren't using Jerusalem as the focal point. They're not necessarily trying to reclaim it or attack it or establish anything in Jerusalem specifically. That's really just like the Fourth and a couple other Crusades. The rest of them sometimes don't even make it into the Middle East itself. They just kind of fizzle out. The last Crusade. From a Christian point of view, and they just kind of continue to carry on these Crusades until the point of 1291, where it doesn't really become politically expedient or financially expedient to keep funding these, and then they just fizzle out at that point. So there is this idea of East versus West that does result from it, where you have kind of these staunch Orthodox Christians, actually, in one of the Crusades, they're trying to get, I think the ultimate goal was try to get back to Jerusalem or that area, and they end up just attacking Constantinople. The Crusaders do. They lay a siege on the city that was formerly their ally. Why? Because Constantinople was a major capital of the world, and there was a lot of wealth in it. So, again, you just go, well, it's obviously just political at this point. There's nothing religious about it. You're attacking the Christians that you initially wanted to unite with, the Christians that you wanted to save from these attacking Seljuk Turks, and it really just creates this dichotomy between Eastern Europe and Asia Minor and the West. And now they kind of clash even more because of the legacy of the Crusades. And then it does serve to establish the political power of Rome, and that's going to continue to be a theme even today, in some ways. Definitely does not have the same, Rome doesn't have the same hold on political leaders today that it did at one point, but there's a reason that the founders were concerned about Catholicism. And it's because they were not that far removed in the 1700s from the Pope actually dictating to the king what he could and couldn't do. And that's why, for so long in the United States, people were uncomfortable having a Catholic as president, because who ultimately would that Catholic answer to then? would they be able to uphold their oath to the Constitution, or would their religious oath to Rome and the Roman Catholic Church supersede that, and then they would be, again, just a puppet of whoever was in power. Now, that never really materialized in the United States that I know of in any significant political office where a Catholic was compromised in that way. But it was a major concern, and the result of it was, going all the way back to the Crusades, how the popes would manipulate the different states in Europe. And then you do actually have the Reformation, which is a result of the Crusades in some regard, in the sense that it begins, the corruption becomes more and more evident in Rome, which makes it more and more evident to those that are Christians in Europe. And of course, Martin Luther's major issue with the Catholic Church was the selling of indulgences, which is something that even the very first crusade was advertising as a way to get people to go on this crusade. So a long history, 500 years removed, essentially, well, 400 and some years removed from the first crusade, the Catholic Church is now selling indulgences again so that they can pay for the expansive art and different upgrades that they're conducting in Rome. And you could even say that, in part, the Crusades kind of lend themselves to the Renaissance itself, but that would get us a little bit too off track. So introducing this idea of comparing Israel, the Hebrews entering Canaan and annihilating these tribes, well, they were supposed to, but we all know that they didn't, and then talking about the Islamic concept of jihad, I want to again introduce this by making sure that we understand the danger of trying to compare and contrast historical events. Sometimes it is useful to do this exercise, and as a teacher, in my teacher education, they encouraged us to do things like this with our students. Activities where you compare and contrast historical events, people, things, right? It can be a worthy exercise because it can help us find the differences between the two, and also say, well, you know, this event in history actually is pretty closely related to another one, and even though they may be spaced apart by several hundred years, there are very similar themes that we can find, and that's a really good tool. So you have the fall of the Roman Empire. People quote that all the time. You know, like Rome is kind of a word of warning to the United States, right? Rome lost its culture. It was more concerned with entertainment than it was protecting its borders. Like, we can, you know, find tons of similarities between issues that were really taking grip in Rome right around the time of its fall and issues that the United States is facing. Population decline, not as many children being born. I'm trying to help with that issue as best I can. Sorry, Jamie's just back there looking at me with a baby sleeping on her. I was like, well, I'm doing my best, okay? We're trying. We don't want the population of the United States to decline too much. But it's always the people that are having kids that are the concern in this day and age, right? It's the ones that aren't having kids that you're like, please, you need to have children. We're going to be taken over by people that are not good. Not responsible. There is a danger of moral and logical fallacies when you try to compare and contrast historical events, though. Judgment of history is so arbitrary and extremely subjective most of the time. So how are we going to make a very substantive, accurate judgment of a person or an event or an entire country, a group of people, a battle, a general? Like, how do you do that? We don't have all the information because most of us are not, did not live through whatever portion of history we're asked to cast judgment on. You know, whether it's slavery or the Civil War or anything like that. It just, there's an infinite amount of knowledge about even just a given topic, and you're never going to acquire enough of it to make a completely accurate judgment. Now, you can make somewhat blanket statements, But when it gets right down to casting judgment on a person for their motives and why they do something, you can't get inside that person's head and know why they did what they did. You know, whether it's George Washington owning slaves, who released all his slaves, gave them freedom when he died, which was not something that the other founders did, right? But he's still put in this extremely negative light. But did we serve on his Virginia plantation? Do we know how those people were treated? Do we know how he acted around them? Do we know that he, in his heart, had animosity and racism as a reason behind that? Or was it a cultural thing? And again, I'm not trying to be an apologist for portions of history where we can say, you know, these are wrong actions or things that we shouldn't do today. But it's a very complicated thing to do. We also fall into this false equivalence fallacy where we wrongfully equate two things and just say that they're similar. So I was scrolling through Twitter the other day, and somebody had tweeted out, and they could have just been kind of making a joke, but based on the context of their tweet and their profile, it didn't seem that they were. But basically saying that with the eclipse, there's going to be another eclipse in several years, and scientists and experts have already accurately labeled where exactly the path of totality is going to be for that eclipse. And it's years in the future, which is, it's an incredible prediction, to be sure. But the person was basically saying, whenever somebody wants you to call into question scientists and experts, just remember that we can accurately predict the path of an eclipse in, you know, several decades. And on the surface, you go, well, I mean, he does kind of have a point. That's a pretty incredible feat that we're able to accomplish with modern science. The issue is that predicting the path of an eclipse and predicting the cause and effect of a pandemic, let's say, two very different things. and so you can't just, or, you know, climate change, for example. Is climate change as easy to measure and predict as the path of an eclipse? Absolutely not. So which experts are you talking about? Which scientists are you talking about? And that's the next fallacy, is the appeal to authority. Like, which experts are you referring to? Because you can't just say experts and scientists. Okay? The perfect example of this fallacy is the toothpaste that says 9 out of 10 dentists support it. 9 out of 10 dentists where? And what relation to what you're talking about? Where are they? Can we see the study that they did? Do you have names of these dentists so that I can call them and say, hey, do you actually put your stamp of approval on this toothpaste? No, it's an appeal to authority. Dentists say it's a good one, so you should buy it. That's not a reason that I should buy it. You're just saying that there are some dentists somewhere that support it. It's the same thing with the 97% of scientists, climate scientists, agree that the Earth is warming and it's because of man-made pollutants. First, that it's even on NASA's website. It's such a fallacy because they're basing it on like a single study of very specific scientists. So you're cherry picking data and saying, okay, can we get how many climate scientists do we know of? And of the ones that study knows of, how many can we get to have a positive response that we're looking for? Like, show me the study in which 97% of scientists agree on anything. It just simply doesn't exist. That number is, well, to use a word that I've already used, arbitrary. You're just coming up with it. Because are you talking to all of the climate scientists? Like, the appeal to the authority is one of the most annoying fallacies to me, because people just assume that because an expert says something, then that means that, okay, well, I guess ultimately that you know, that's the authority that you know, is enough for me to make a decision on it. Now, of course, the ultimate authority is God. So if you're going to appeal to God's authority, if you're going to appeal to the Bible, the authority of God's word, then yeah, we can have a conversation, because that is something that's unchangeable. okay? But anything apart from that, if you're going to, you know, reference an authority that's a fallible person, I'll look at their opinion because they're an expert on the subject, but I'm not necessarily just going to take at face value whatever they say just because of their title or how many letters they have after their name. That's not how logical ideas work. Mr. Hergert, did you have a question? Oh, because your birthday was...
It was dark in Texas when she was
born. Oh.
When they took contact, so they said, she said, the guy blew out your candle for your birthday today.
That's pretty funny.
And
so
I'm always going to remember this eclipse.
Yeah, and it was a pretty significant one. They said that it was, in terms of the amount of population that was affected by the path of totality, it was the biggest, I guess you could say. So that's pretty cool. It was on your birthday. Yeah.
I've been feeling good all week now.
That's why, because the eclipse was on your birthday. God blew out the sun just for you.
Yeah, so I've been thanking him for every day for what he does. For the eclipse they do.
So we have to talk about God's perfect will as well when we compare and contrast historical events, because God, of course, does not will that things like war and certain things in history would happen. Of course, the most obvious example of that is Adam's fall, Adam and Eve's fall in the garden. It was not God's perfect will that took place. And it's a concept that's kind of difficult to completely wrap our minds around, because we know that God is in control, but he has a perfect will where, it's the Bible passages that talk about, God doesn't will that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. Does that mean that nobody is going to perish and that all are going to come to repentance? No, it just means that that's what he wants to happen. That's what he wills to happen. In his perfect will, that's what would happen. Man would always have a perfect, harmonious relationship with him. But God also gives men freedom of choice and decision. He did not create us to be these robots that just do whatever he says. That, of course, is in no way going to bring honor and glory to him. If we don't have a choice, then there really is no relationship, right? That's why a lot of times marriages that are where the person isn't choosing the other person, they're just maybe going off of emotions, or maybe it's a marriage that's just kind of a setup, or they feel kind of pressured into it. There is an actual choice to be made there, and the fact that a husband and a wife choose each other, there's something special there, because they could choose someone else, right? And so if my wife had no other choice but to marry me, then I would kind of question at several times whether or not she actually did love me, or whether she was staying with me because she didn't have any other choice. She's just locked into this now, but I know that she could have chosen other guys. That would have been a terrible decision, but she could have. And a lot, she would have found plenty of other fantastic guys that would have wanted to marry her. But she chose me. So you know how that makes me feel? Great. That makes me feel very special. Okay? And it's very similar with God's relationship with us. If we're not going to choose to serve him and choose to love him, then what glory is there in that relationship? There really is none. It's just kind of automatic, and that'll come up later as well. The other thing is, what's the standard by which you judge? And I'll have you guys turn to Romans 2, 1 through 3. Because, of course, these verses on judgment like Pastor accurately references, are constantly taken out of context. But really the basis of it is about the hypocrisy. And the always when the Bible talks about the danger of judgment, it's in relation to this idea that the judgment and the standard that you use on another person is going to be the same standard that's used against you. So, and I don't know exactly how God is going to apply that type of judgment, because we know that all of us are held to God's standard, and that by God's standard of judgment, all of us are going to stand redeemed in Jesus Christ or condemned in our own sin. Okay? But this idea that we could stand before God, and I think it's probably talking about Christians more so than the unsaved, but the idea that we would be held accountable to God for our hypocrisy by holding people to standards that we ourselves don't meet is extremely sobering. Because it's not just that, you know, we say something like, you know, I go to church as a Christian, this other Christian that I know does not go to church. And so I'm holding him to the standard of church attendance, and I know that, and you know, maybe it's out of pride, right? I'm better than this person because I go to church and he doesn't, okay? And that person would even say in their pride, well, I'm totally fine with God holding me to that standard because I actually do follow through with it, right? But it's more about like the heart condition, the heart of the judgment, and really the meat at which you're doing the judging. Not so much the very specific thing that you're judging someone for. Because the Bible always addresses the heart and the intentions, and God is the only one that can know that and see that. So the outward thing, it may manifest itself as, I'm better than this person because I don't do something, or I do something that they do or don't. But really, there's a bigger heart issue that you're going to be held accountable for, because yeah, while you may hold yourself up to a standard that you can meet, are you actually casting judgment in a way that is biblical? Because there could be a very similar situation where that person looks at you and judges you based on another just kind of non-biblical metric or standard, right? And both of you are going to be held accountable even if you do meet your standard, because you're judging that person based on something that's not, that can't be substantiated, right? It's just out of the actual sin of the heart, the pride, and the maybe the guilt that we feel. We want to bring ourselves above someone else, and so we judge someone based on, what they do or don't, and so that raises us above them. Right? That heart issue, that's what's going to be addressed. I really do believe that, because in Romans it says, you have no excuse, foolish person. And I'm going to switch to the KJV. Therefore, thou art inexcusable, O man, whosoever thou art that judgest, for wherein thou judgest another, thou condemnest thyself, for thou that judgest doest the same things. But we are sure that the judgment of God is according to the truth against them which commit such things. And thinkest thou this, O man, that judgest them which do such things and doest the same, that thou shalt escape the judgment of God? I always think of, kind of liberal Christianity and how they get so upset about conservative Christians because they, say that, we dress up for church and we don't have rock music in our services and we do all these things and then we're casting judgment on them because they maybe don't live out their Christianity the same way that we do. And yet, the finger is still pointing back at us. Like, you're still judging us based on what we do. We're judging you based on what you don't. So, regardless of who's right, and right, we're at Westside Baptist Church for a reason. We feel that worship is something that should be structured in a specific way. And I'm not trying to get into that argument. I'm just saying that they're guilty of the same thing that they're accusing us of. Because they're judging us based on our standards and saying, you can't judge me based on my lack of standards. Well, so what at the root of the argument, the issue is still the same. And your still standing in judgment of me as someone who's conservative as a liberal. Like, the relationship is still the same. It's just that you're too ignorant to realize that you're guilty of the same thing. Okay? And again, that's where I say it's not so much as I get to set the standards for my life, and the measure by which I judge everyone else is by which I'm going to be judged, so I better do everything that I say. It's that you're still hypocritical in your ideology. You're still judging someone based on the same theme, based on the same idea. Okay? It may not be a specific action. So that might be a little bit confusing, but it's very important to understand that when we get into what we're going to be talking about. This is all review, just talking about jihad. The Quran does approve in Surah 9 of the annihilation of idolaters. Usually that's where we find this extermination theme. It talks about idolaters, and then it kind of differentiates Christians and Jews by calling them people of the book. But then there's this question with some Quranic commentators that would then associate Christians and Jews with idolaters, and then it would give excuse for taking these violent acts against Christians and Jews. Because very often, as we've said, the Quran is very friendly and kind of has this openness towards Christians and Jews because they believe that our beliefs are very similar and we're all related in the sense that it's an Abrahamic religion. And so we're not to be treated, in some passages of the Quran, the same way that non-believers, pagans, are to be treated. So if you're outside of the Abrahamic religion, there's a much stricter standard that the Quran sets in how you should be treated. And a lot of times that's where we do find this violence of killing and exterminating people. But again, it's how do you apply that passage on idolatry? And then with this excerpt from Nickel in the Christian commentary on the Quran, trying to find a context for many Quranic passages, including those with the imperative to kill and fight, can be difficult because the reader cannot clearly know whether a command is time-bound or limited or timeless and universal. So in the Bible, when God commands Israel to go into Canaan, it is very obviously time-bound because he's very specific on who they're supposed to be exterminating. And there's several other passages later where they're not supposed to, where the children of Israel are not necessarily supposed to take those actions. Right? So, it's not as though God then ordains them going back into Egypt and annihilating the Egyptians, right? It's just a very specific place and time that he's ordering this. And so the Bible is very clear, whereas the Quran is not. Okay, so we don't know whether it's time-bound or it's supposed to be a universal command. And it seems that it just kind of goes with whatever Muhammad needs the religion of Islam to accomplish at whatever time he receives the vision. Again, this is review. The idea of jihad, just remember, it's not always a holy war or it doesn't always manifest itself in violence. Especially for most Muslims that are not associated with terrorist actions or violent themselves, they would say that this idea of jihad, which can be found in the Quran, don't let anybody tell you it can't be found, but they would apply this as an internal struggle. Okay, so jihad is supposed to be, if it's actually exercised as violence and attacking people, it's supposed to be a judgment of those practicing idolatry and false religion. Okay, it's supposed to be in someone's individual life, an internal struggle for righteousness, to do the right thing, because Muslims believe your life is essentially a giant scale. The good things have to outweigh the bad things. Okay, so there's a jihad there. There's a struggle to do the right thing and not do the wrong thing. And it also could be used, if it's outright war, as defense against someone, because the Quran does, and I don't remember which surah it's in, but it specifically talks about that war is justified if it's in defense. If you're fighting against someone that's attacking you, then self-defense is justified, and that could be maybe looked at as jihad, as a struggle for your religion and for Allah as well. But in practice, how do we see jihad actually being lived out? It seems like it's being used as more of a physical threat to force conversion, because there are a lot of forced conversions, especially at the very beginning of the foundation of Islam, where The best example of that is Muhammad marching back to Mecca with his giant army and intimidating the people of Mecca to just give in to his newfound political and military power. And then there's a bunch of conversions in Mecca. So just all of a sudden, they all just feel very inwardly convicted that they want to become Muslim. No, it's forced conversion. If there's an army outside the gates of the city, then the message is pretty clear. Convert to Islam or I've got an army. Okay? So you can't really say that it doesn't happen. And it happening all the way back at the very beginning while Muhammad was still alive really seems to lend itself to this idea that jihad and violence in Islam is really for this intimidation and conversion of people. But it's also an excuse just for expansion because once Muslim as a religion breaks out of the Arabian Peninsula, then what's the reasoning behind that? How do you tie that into a religious theme? And this is where we have to be very careful with combining military accomplishments with biblical mandates or God's approval. Okay, and as Americans, it seems very easy for us to do this because the United States is a Christian country that was founded upon Western values, which are based in the Bible and Judeo-Christian principles. So if we lose a battle, does that mean, as Americans, does that mean that God is not on our side? And if we win a battle, does that mean he is on our side? And it's difficult to make blanket statements like that because if you look at some of the wars that the United States has waged, they were not fought for good causes, but we still won. So what does that mean? That God blessed the cause of, expansion into the Pacific or the Spanish-American War or the Mexican-American War, where the U.S. president marches his troops deliberately onto Mexican territory to ignite a fight. Vietnam, for example, where the government openly lied about the Gulf of Tonkin incident so that the United States could get militarily involved. Now, the intention of the U.S. might have been good in the sense that it wanted to stop the spread of communism into Vietnam, but that incident in and of itself, does that mean if the United States would have won Vietnam that it was okay for that to happen? No. So you can't always make those comparisons. Now, with the American Revolution, it does actually seem that the United States was fighting for a cause that was just, and the establishment of the United States has brought about a lot of good things. A lot of people have gotten saved because the United States is able to send missionaries. There's a positive influence in the world because the United States stood for decades and generations on legal principles that were based in the Bible. And those are all good things, and God allowed that to happen. But that doesn't always mean that if somebody is fighting for the best causes, that they just automatically win, because it could be God's will that they don't win, right? But a lot of times the Muslims, it's immediately equated as soon as this empire expands, oh, Allah is blessing our actions because we're winning. So Allah is not blessing your actions, even if they're identical actions, if you lose. So then how are you supposed to make a decision on that? So are you supposed to be doing it or not? Because you lost the last time, right? And then, all kinds of excuses are being made. You know, our faith wasn't great enough or, what have you. But, yes, Mrs. Ortel? Yeah, it's about what's in your heart, right?
Yeah.
Are you a forgiving person? Are you casting judgment in a kind way? Because we're supposed to be people that are discerning, right? If you see somebody doing something bad, what is in your heart? Okay, so if somebody does something that's concerning to you, who do you tell? Do you tell the person who you're concerned with? Because that would show a heart of forgiveness in my mind. That I actually want this person to do the right thing. I feel that they're not, so I'm going to go to them. But in my mind, the hypocrisy begins when you start talking to somebody else about it. Because then you don't really care whether or not that person does or doesn't do it. You just care about how it makes you feel to bring them down by talking about them doing it or not doing it, right? So that's why I think that heart and how your heart and your inward self commands what you do on the outside. The Bible talks about it over and over, and 1 John is a great, great book for that, about how if you don't do the commandments of Jesus, then you're probably not saved. Like it's, you know, it's not works-based salvation, but it's very practical Christian living. If you're not doing the things that show that you love Jesus, then you probably don't love him. And I'm saying probably, because 1 John says you don't. Right? And again, using my wife as an example, if I say that I love her, but I don't, there's no demonstration of the fact that I love her, then is there still a problem? Yeah. The demonstration, that has to be demonstrated in some manner, or else the conclusion is that you don't. Right? So the heart is such a big thing that, and I'm glad you made that comment, because it is. It's very difficult to cast these intentions and say, well, we know what this person was doing historically. We don't know what their intentions were. We can only judge them based on what we do know. Okay, so let's go to Deuteronomy 20, 16, and 17. The 1 Samuel passage is actually, of course, after Joshua has died, and this is the command, it's the command to Saul that he has to exterminate the Amalekites. He's supposed to devote everything to destruction. So it's a similar command, right? But again, very specific command, right? Very specific group of people at a very specific time. And it's not like God is constantly commanding Saul to do this. At this specific time, he's like, these are a remnant of the people of Canaan that were not exterminated, and you need to go do it. He's not saying, go find everybody who's not a Jew and behead them or kill them and tell them they have to convert or else they're going to die. And we'll just do that throughout the whole world. That's not God's intention, right? It's very, very, very specific. So Deuteronomy 20, 16 through 17. And I had you guys turn there and I wasn't turning. But of the cities of these people, these would be the Canaanites, which the Lord thy God doth give thee for an inheritance, thou shalt save alive nothing that breatheth. Thou shalt utterly destroy them, namely the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, as the Lord thy God hath commanded thee. So he's naming names. These are the groups of people that you are supposed to destroy and save nothing alive that breatheth. So there's the command. This is where I'm going to take it a different direction than you probably predicted, and I spent so much time on everything before this that I'm glad I have another week, because this is really the... and as I was doing my study and praying about this, this is at the very core of the argument. Okay? Because everybody wants, whenever you argue about something like this, they want... Okay, so tell me why, from a logical perspective, and formulate all these arguments, and then debate against somebody who's a Muslim and just destroy him and say, Israelites were right to exterminate the Canaanites, and the Muslims were wrong for their expansion of empire and their terrorist activities and all this other stuff, right? But you really have to look at what is at the actual crux of the argument. What are we actually talking about here? Okay. And what you're actually talking about is whether or not God is moral in commanding something like that. Because he did command it. There's no debate about that. We just looked at John 20, and there's several other passages where God commands it. So we know that he commands it. So how can it be justified? How can it be something that God can actually mandate? This is an argument from an atheist named Sam Harris. How many of you have heard of Sam Harris? He's kind of taken over for Richard Dawkins and some of the other household names of atheism. He's actually a very intelligent person, which often these people are. Definitely, from an objective point of view, hold his own in a debate against somebody like me or any of us. He's a very, very bright person that knows a lot, but he doesn't know this. And I actually almost hesitate to read this because it is so just outright defiance of God. But it's important that we understand what atheists believe. And there's a lot of people that adopted Sam Harris's doctrine. So he says in this excerpt from an atheist manifesto, "If God exists, either he can do nothing to stop the most egregious calamities or he does not care to. God, therefore, is either impotent or evil. Pious readers will now execute the following pirouette. God cannot be judged by merely human standards of morality. But of course, human standards of morality are precisely what the faithful use to establish God's goodness in the first place. And any God who could concern himself with something as trivial as gay marriage or the name by which he is addressed in prayer is not as inscrutable as all that. If he exists, the God of Abraham is not merely unworthy of the immensity of creation, he is unworthy even of man. There is another possibility, of course, and it is both the most reasonable and least odious. The biblical God is a fiction. It is terrible that we all die and lose everything we love. It is doubly terrible that so many human beings suffer needlessly while alive. That so much of this suffering can be directly attributed to religion, to religious hatreds, wars, delusions, diversions of scarce resources, is what makes atheism a moral and intellectual necessity. It is a necessity, however, that places the atheist at the margins of society. The atheist, by merely being in touch with reality, appears shamefully out of touch with the fantasy life of his neighbors." Right? And this is not his only argument that's presented in his atheist manifesto, in which his, of course, atheists do not believe in God. He's trying to disprove the existence of God. This part of his argument is based upon the morality of God. So if we believe, the God that we believe in, the Christian God, or even the Muslim Allah, or even any other type of deity, if he is all good, then how can bad things happen? Okay, it's the age-old argument. But it also creates a substantial obstacle for us as Christians, because it is a very difficult question to answer. And if you think about all of the bad things that have happened just over the last couple days, let alone the entirety of history, you really start thinking about, there's a lot of bad stuff that happens. There's a lot of people that are killed and that are not just killed quickly, right? There are people that are murdered at the hands of someone who is a complete monster, right? And God is all powerful and God created everything and God is in control. And yet we know, and we have to come to terms with as Christians, that these things are happening, right? And even when we say, well, it's man's fault that those things are happening, the argument that he's making is, well, if God is all powerful and he can control everything, why would he even allow that to happen in the first place? Because he obviously knows that it's happening. And if he's all powerful, he could do something to stop it. So why then would he not? And it's the why part of that that causes Christians so much issue. Because same thing with Israel going into Canaan. Why exterminate them? Why not just have them all convert, right? Why not have them show obeisance to the children of Israel? Could God not have had that happen? You go, well, yeah, but God needed to judge those people. Well, yeah, but there's women and children. Children were annihilated by Hebrews that go into Canaan, and God not only allows it to happen, but he actually sanctioned it. But you said God is all good, so how does that happen? And unfortunately, we have to talk about this next week. I don't mean to leave you hanging, but I think it is going to be good for us to think about that, or actually over the next 2 weeks, because Mike Schrock will be here next week. But to think about that, how would you explain that to someone like Sam Harris, and many, many other Americans and people across the world who share this exact same point of view? You say God's all good, right? Okay, but his judgment of sin is so extreme that he allows all of the worst possible things that we can imagine to happen. So how do you reconcile that? that's what we'll look at in a couple weeks.